VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, Chelsea win themselves a second Champions League title. What went so right for Thomas Tuchel and so wrong for Pep Guardiola? We'll discuss the England squad as they begin preparations for Euro 2020. What's it like behind the scenes at a major competition? And welcome to the Premier League, Brentford. This is The Game. I'm Hugh Woozencroft. To help me through it all, Tom Roddy, Matt Lawton and Matt Dickinson. Gentlemen, how are you?
Morning, Hugh. How you doing?
I'm very well. How are you, Tom Roddy? I'll start with a weekend in Porto that was probably one to remember, especially as you were with Matt, weren't you?
Exactly. Yeah,
me and a weekend with me is always one to remember. Yes. No, it was romantic strolls down the Douro River. No, it was great, Tom, wasn't it? Great to be there.
It was fantastic. Yeah, really good. Especially after the last year and going to empty stadiums constantly to even with the few scuffles that did happen, the atmosphere was incredible.
You and Matt scuffling, were you? Well, that's a new thing. Gentlemen, just in the vein of Tom Clark.
That was over who was going to pay the bar bill. I don't know how it came over on the TV, but it felt like 100,000 in there, to be honest. I don't know whether that was just, I mean, it's a great stadium anyway, but whether just because everyone else was so chuffed to be there, but it really did feel like a banging atmosphere. I do hope that came over on the TV.
It felt like a good Champions League final, if that makes sense, for once. I had the feeling going into it that we would see a good game. I think we could have seen an even better game, and we'll get to Manchester City in a moment, but we have to start with Chelsea. Congratulations to them winning their second Champions League title, a 1-0 win over City in Porto. The record for the least goals conceded on the way to a Champions League victory, just 4. Kai Havertz with his first goal in the competition this season, and that was the decider, of course. But you have to give credit to the victors, as I say, especially the manager Thomas Tuchel and Chelsea as well. But Matt Dickinson, I will ask you what you felt being inside the stadium was the key to their win.
I think what was the key to them getting there, it was, you know, a clarity of organisation, of purpose, and players who were willing to perform those tasks to the, you know, they could have, I think I wrote on the night that, you know, you could still have had Rudiger and Azpilicueta tackling 24 hours later. They were, I mean, I just thought they were, Kante inevitably and deservedly got all the main plaudits. He was, you know, we're so used to seeing him, you know, pop up in 10 places all at the same time. And even by his standards, he was astonishing. But I didn't think too far behind him, particularly with Rudiger and Azpilicueta. I thought they had a difficult task because, you know, we know the City, the way they move, you know, can flummox and pull defenders out of the way. But they had a brilliant knack of closing, you know, striding out defence to close down if necessary, somehow always being there to do those sort of blocks for the cutbacks as well. And yeah, I mean, I thought they were sensational in defence. I mean, there were great performances everywhere, but you know, you just know with that Chelsea team that once they get 1-0 up, you would back them to defend against any team. And so it proved.
Matt Lawson, how much credit do you think the manager Thomas Tuchel deserves after coming in when Frank Lampard was dismissed in January, I think?
I think he deserves massive credit. And I think one of the things that struck me watching it from home, because Tom and Matt probably weren't aware of this, but it was quite strange on Saturday night. There were a lot of comments on social media sort of wanting to acknowledge the role that Lampard played in the success on Saturday night. And I was kind of thinking, I'm not really sure about that because, look, he did a decent job in the relatively brief time that he was in charge, Lampard. But I think what Tuchel has demonstrated since he took charge of Chelsea, and I bow to the sort of, you know, the fact that Tom and Matt have probably seen a lot more on Chelsea than I have this season, which is in the flesh nothing because of the job I do for the Times. But I just thought he Tuchel exposed Lampard's inexperience as a manager. And I think what Tuchel has done since he, you know, sometimes it's very hard to define what managers actually do, what coaching is. But I think he's perfectly demonstrated the contrast between the Chelsea pre-January and post-January is massive. And they suddenly became a team that could defend. They suddenly became a team that was organised. You know, as we saw on Saturday night, was a team that was had balance and structure and a plan against a team that had kind of been thrown together on the whim of a manager. And you know, and the end result was a 1-0 victory for Chelsea. So I think he deserves far more credit than he was getting. Because as I say, I was slightly stunned by the sort of the wish by a lot of people. And I'm talking prominent sort of commentators saying, oh, we must recognise the role that Lampard played. And I'm thinking, no, come on, give the guy some credit here. He's taking them to a whole other level. And I think that needs to be recognised.
Tom Roddy, what did you make of the game? Of course, you're inside the stadium. The positive things when it comes to Chelsea that they did on the night, there were a couple of big decisions to make. Firstly, in terms of the team selection for Chelsea, they got those right. And also the performance, which, as Matt alluded to already, couldn't have been far better than what they showed.
No, exactly. I was actually struck as well by the sort of celebrations at the end and the guys on the peripheries of that team who were completely overcome with sort of emotion and the joy of it all. And it said something about what Thomas Tuchel has done there, in that he's created this united team, which they weren't before he came in at all. There was infighting going on, and that was the first thing that he said to the team when he met them was, if we're going to be successful, we need to work together rather than against each other. And that's what they did. That was what they did in Porto, because as Matt said quite rightly, you saw that Lampard team, and when you compare the two, I mean, even picking out Reece James as one example, I've never seen him defend as he did in Porto, and I think that is a lot of that is down to Thomas Tuchel. I think part of the questioning over who should be England's right back, he was seen as more of an attacking player, Reece James, but Thomas Tuchel has brought out this shown the balance that he has. I mean, Andreas Christensen is a player who's been seen as unreliable and quite fragile and has a mistake in him over the last sort of couple of years, and especially at the beginning of this season. And he came into a game in the 36th minute into the Champions League final when they've lost Thiago Silva, who was the most experienced player in that team. And he just slotted in perfectly. I mean, there was a big opportunity, I think it was Aguero had at the end. And every single one of the six defenders who played in the back made last-ditch tackles. It wasn't like City didn't get opportunities. They did. It was just Chelsea were so organised and so determined that they couldn't make it count.
Tom, do you think it's a new deal already on the table for Tuchel?
Yeah, it was quite funny that was the first time that Thomas Tuchel and Roman Abramovich had met on the pitch at the Dragao. And as Tuchel said, it can kind of only really go down from here. He delivered the Champions League for him. But they met again yesterday morning after the final. And the talks went well. And I think we'll see a new contract with a year extension and an option for another announced within maybe today, maybe the next couple of days, which is completely understandable. I mean, The thing with this, the comparisons between, or the contrast between 2012 and this year, that was a team that kind of came, 2012 was a team that came to the end, was coming to the end of their sort of cycle. Whereas this team, this group, feels like one which is almost at the beginning. This is so far ahead of schedule. And I think Tuchel was the man who sort of pulled it all together and sees himself staying there for a while. I still think it'll be interesting to see what happens over transfers if he doesn't get the transfers he'd like, but that could lead to some fallouts.
We will see, but I think Roman Abramovich has to be confident that he's got the right man in charge. As you say, having been delivered the Champions League in his first meeting with the boss. But yeah, I think we're going to have to put up with a decade of this player as a Champions League winner every time an English player, young English player now, has a bad game, whether it be Reece James or Mason Mount from here on out. So let's hope they don't have a dip in form, because they will, of course, in the best possible way, have that hanging over them, if you see what I mean. And there, look, there are players in this Chelsea team that I think we do have to talk about. We'll come to Manchester City shortly, but Matt Dickinson, you mentioned him already, the man of the match, N'Golo Conte. Is he now a footballing legend?
Well, he already was in Leicester. He must be most of the way there at in West London. I mean, he's just a marvel to watch in that, you know, sometimes you really do think, hang on a minute, I just saw him tackling in that box. What the hell's he doing? How's he got back? You know, it's almost like there's some sort of magic illusion going on. His timing of just being able to sort of that sixth sense of, you know, I'm going to win the second ball here. He just has this incredible knack. I mean, the energy, I think the humility that he shows is very touching. I think that's, people see that he is the last one to go up and grab the trophy. You know, when they do these presentations, you know, they're all, you see the sort of eager ones who are like, give it to me as fast as possible. I want my picture. And he's always the one sort of loitering slightly shyly at the back. And it's just the fact he's winning all the biggest honours in the game. And I think on top of that, I just think, you know, we've seen, you know, the Messi, Ronaldo sort of Ballon d'Or era, and rightly so. I mean, it's just, you know, it's fantastic to see it. And someone like a Modric comes along, and a different player, but a sort of creative schemer. It would just be fantastic for the game to see someone like Kante, given not just, you know, winning the biggest club and country honours, but to maybe even the biggest individual honours, just to show that the game, every great team could do with a Kante in it. I mean, is there any side that would not be better for him? I can't think of one.
Chelsea legend Ashley Cole describing him as a Claude Makélélé plus extras. 5 years now since he won the title at Leicester. Since then, he's been a runner-up in the Europa League final and at Euro 2016. He's played in four FA Cup finals. He's won it once. He's won a Europa League. He's won a Premier League, another Premier League with Chelsea. He's won the World Cup, of course, now the Champions League as well. And he didn't play in the top flight in France until 2014. Matt Lawton, where do you think he ranks beside the best midfielders of his generation?
I agree with Ashley Cole. I think he is Makélélé with extras, because I think he's more dynamic than the sort of Deschamps, Makélélé kind of players. I think he's more, although his character on the pitch is nothing like it, he has the sort of dynamism that Keane had in his absolute prime at United and for Ireland. You know, it's just that kind of... he's a player that just, I think the key difference, and it was certainly evident in the first half an hour on Saturday night, was just that Chelsea were just more, they were more tenacious. They were just more up for it, weren't they? They stepped up onto the big stage and clearly mentally were more ready for it than City were. And he, I thought, epitomised that attitude, that, you know, that commitment to the game, and he has done again. Yeah, say, you know, he's virtually got the full set. You know, he's runner up in the European Championship in 2016, but he's got everything else. And who says they won't do it this summer? You know, he's a special player. All the best teams have somebody like that. You know, the sort of Brazil teams we saw in 2002, the great German teams we've seen, as I said, the French teams, whether it's Deschamps or Makélélé, you need a player like that. And what Guardiola forgets is that his best Barcelona teams had somebody like Busquets. And just odd that he, like, we'll get onto this, but it's just very odd that he didn't pick the bloke that does that job for City, because it was exposed as a mistake, because you know the successful teams have someone performing that role, and he's as good as they get in that position.
Yeah, congratulations to Chelsea and N'Golo Conte, a second Champions League title. It was improbable, really, when you thought about it, when Thomas Tuchel came into the job, but yes, he's done fantastically well. And again, they performed when it really mattered. Matt Lawton, I think you're absolutely right about that. You saw the two sets of players, and for me, maybe it got to Manchester City's players more. But yeah, a five-star review from N'Golo Conte, who didn't flinch at all. And remember, if you're enjoying the podcast, leave us a five-star review as well, wherever you can get your podcast from right now, of course. Let's talk about Manchester City, because for me, they were beyond disappointing. It started with the team selection. Tom Roddy, you asked Pep Guardiola after the game if he had any regrets. Do you think he will? And if so, what will he regret?
Yeah, I think he definitely will. And I also think, his players, his team probably had felt the regrets probably before they'd even kicked off the game. I thought Fernandinho was certain to play that game. It was a couple of weeks ago, I think it was the Everton game, he came in. And he's 36 years old, but the experience that he brought to that game, you saw the value in it. There's been an overhaul and evolution that Guardiola has done at City, bringing players through, moving players on, which we've seen with Aguero. But Fernandinho in that central defensive midfield position offers so much, and that's why we thought he would play ahead of Rodri, because he has the kind of experience and nous to play in those big games, and neither of them were there. And I remember in Monday's pod we were talking about the idea of Pep overthinking the game and being, we didn't think he would because of him being so confident this year, but I just wondered whether Thomas Tuchel, being the tactician he is and the battles they've had before in Germany when Tuchel was at Mainz and Dortmund and Guardiola was at Bayern, whether he would. And it seemed like he did. And it was just, everyone says it's easy to say in hindsight, but you looked at that game and thought, well, against, we've just spoken about the quality of Kante, and against the best player in world football at nipping in and taking the ball and then driving forward. I mean, the comparisons to Makelele are totally true, but he's so much more than that, because he's not David Silva, but he's more than capable of driving forward, countering and playing the perfect pass to a teammate. He can do that. And City were just completely open to it, and we saw it with the goal. I mean, it was a fantastic goal, a brilliant pass from Mason Mount, quick thinking from Mendy in the goal, and also a fantastic run from Timo Werner to set up, to open up that space and pull Diaz out wide. But surely, if there was a defensive midfielder in there, that doesn't happen. City aren't so open. I couldn't believe that they were that open in a Champions League final game. So that was the biggest surprise to me. It was the biggest surprise for most people. And I think they'll go on to regret it until they do it, until they get over the line.
Matt Dickinson, can you explain it? No Fernandinho or Rodri in the starting 11 for the first time in 60 games this season?
Well, I mean, I think Pep offered his sort of cursory, you know, he looked pretty sort of shell-shocked. He had this sort of slightly fixed, sort of, not really smile, but he just had this sort of slightly glazed expression on him. I think he was almost punched drunk on Saturday night. I think he explained it by saying he wanted Gundogan to be there because he wanted quicker circulation of the ball. I mean, I was really struck. It's not the first time they've done it, but they lined up, they had kickoff, they had seven men on the halfway line, and basically, I mean, I've written this morning, it was almost like, you know, they could have started with a bugle call the way they just charged, you know, they just absolutely hurtled at Chelsea, and it was almost like they started as if we're going to swarm into you. We are just going to pin this back. We are going to dominate the ball so much. We're going to circulate it so fast. We are going to ultra press you. And sort of for 5 minutes, you thought, wow, this is, you know, this is clearly going to be, you know, sort of full on. We've seen the team selection, and we had, you know, it wasn't just hindsight. We had sort of looked at that and thought, wow, what has he done here? And we saw that strategy in those first 5 minutes. And I think what rattled City was the fact that that Chelsea weren't rattled. I think they expected them to be pinned back, expected to get the ball, circulate it fast. And Chelsea, because of someone like Kante and others, started repelling the fire. They started nicking the ball off them. They started driving them back. They started showing that they weren't going to be rattled out of it. And you sort of very quickly saw in De Bruyne and in Mahrez and in Foden that they weren't getting time on the ball. They weren't getting to dominate the ball. They weren't getting it to circulate it as they would like. And yeah, it fell apart. It felt like that game strategy was being picked apart within 10, 15 minutes. And I think that was the surprise, was that I think we were all saying that in the press. Say again, it wasn't, you know, we get accused of hindsight enough and possibly fairly, but this was one where we were all talking to each other, looking at each other in the press box going, this isn't working. This is not working. And that was the other big surprise, I guess, was that it took, you know, took a good hour before it was changed.
I totally agree. I think 14 minutes was the time officially for me that it was change it, Pep, because I think that was when Timo Werner had his second good opportunity to score, and they were really lucky for the game still to be goalless. And I think it was evident that they were far too open. I've got no idea what he would see.
Well, I mean, one thing I would say is that, you know, it's possible. I mean, Fernandinho is 36. You know, I don't think it's not necessarily a, you know, one man change. You know, Chelsea were fantastic. Might have been fantastic, you know, against any collection of City players. But I do think, you know, it does send a message to a team when a manager makes a decision like that. When he makes it, and the other thing, you know, we ought to stress is that he had played Rodri or Fernandinho in 59 of the previous 60 games. So this is a message. This is lads, we're doing it differently today. This is not, you know, we've got a structure, we're going to stick to our structure. This is, guys, you know, I am being bold here. I am trusting you to do something different from the norm. And that was what was, so, you know, people can say and have said and possibly rightly said, oh, well, you know, could we be sure Fernandinho would have closed down Mason Mount? Could he have cut out that pass? Maybe not. Maybe Chelsea still win. But I do think, you know, that what no one can dispute is that Guardiola did say to his team, we are going to do something different, and we're going to do it in the biggest game in the club's history. And when you do that, that is a heck of a gamble.
Matt Lawton, with this approach, I often think with Manchester City, you play the perfect game. Everyone says how brilliant you are. We all talk about Pep Guardiola as a genius. Anything less than the perfect game, and they struggle. They struggle to score goals. Kevin De Bruyne, who for me is one of the best players in the world, full stop. But to put him in a position as a false nine where he's almost ahead of the ball a lot of the time, never really gets on it, had to keep coming deeper to try and get on it, obviously eventually had the bad injury and went off. But it was like Guardiola wasn't getting the message. It felt, especially for a fan, I think for the fans, it felt like almost a wasted opportunity for the greatest Champions League final of all time because of Guardiola and how he approached it. But how do you think it affects him at the club now?
Oh, I think he's still won the Premier League title. I think he's fine. And I think now they will come back. You know, I think the key thing with what happened on Saturday is, you know, we've seen teams have certain deficiencies and still succeed. You know, we watched the France team win the World Cup in 98 without a striker. Now, they did have Zinedine Zidane, and they even had a young Thierry Henry playing wide right. So, you know, teams can overcome that. The problem they had on Saturday night is that they not only didn't have a pure striker, they didn't have anyone winning the ball in midfield. So it's very hard to make up for those deficiencies if you're not winning the midfield battle either. Guardiola's got enough credit in the bank. Good grief. And I don't see him walking away. He now needs to come back. This is a fresh incentive, isn't it, to come back and get it right. The one thing he hasn't done since he left Barcelona is win the Champions League again. And it is a boil that needs to be pierced. And it's, you know, it's probably a slightly unpleasant analogy that I'm getting into here, but it's going to be even sorer today, isn't it? So he does need to get back there, and he will have the, you know, we've all been you know, we've all been writing about the potential arrivals this summer, be it Declan Rice or Harry Kane or whatever. So he's going to address those deficiencies. But, you know, the thing about Guardiola, Hugh, that you got to, you know, and I live in Manchester, he's made a pretty big commitment to Manchester. You know, in a way that Mourinho, it was a fleeting visit. You know, he never moved out of the Lowry Hotel. You know, Guardiola's put proper roots down in this city. And, you know, he's got a home in the city centre. He's invested in a local restaurant. I know there were doubts about his future a year ago before he signed that new contract, but he's here for the long haul. And I don't see the owners of Manchester City turning around and going, this bloke's not good enough. We need to find a new manager. That's just not going to happen.
How long, though, until it starts creeping into the consciousness that it seems like the Champions League and the fact that he hasn't won it now for 10 years, hasn't won it without Lionel Messi in his side, creeps into the psyche of not just Guardiola, but the hierarchy at Manchester City as well? Because it's the way that he keeps changing in this competition, the way that he keeps trying to surprise everyone and do something different in the Champions League, suddenly, for me, makes people think that maybe the Champions League is getting to him in some way.
I don't know about that. It took Fergie 13 years to win the Champions League. You know, and Matt and I were, you know, young reporters in Manchester when all that was happening. And you know, there were the failures. There was the semi-final against Borussia Dortmund. There was the quarter-final against Monaco. There was the absolute hiding against Barcelona, you know, albeit restricted by how many foreign players he could pick at that time. But it's part of the... I honestly think he messed up on Saturday night, but it's part of the evolution of this, of the club and the team. And I don't think it's ever a given that you can win this thing. I know Chelsea have won it twice and then they also got into a final, which is remarkable, really, from sort of relative European novices to suddenly, you know, they've reached three finals in whatever it is since 2008 and they've won it twice. It's a hell of a record. Particularly when he changes the manager as much as he does. I just think they'll get it right, Hugh. Yeah, we can't sit here and say that Manchester City are not good enough to win the Champions League. They are good enough to win the Champions League. And if they get Harry Kane, it's a great incentive for Harry Kane, isn't it, to come and finally deliver that big trophy.
Which leads us nicely on to my next question. Matt Dickinson, does this force Manchester City to do something big in the summer transfer market, the likes of Harry Kane or Erling Haaland?
Well, I think I tweeted after about half an hour that Harry Kane's value had gone up by another 100 million. I think, you know, you saw Chelsea, I mean, Timo Werner obviously missing those chances, as we've become accustomed to. But I mean, if Harry Kane had been in either team, you'd have backed him to have filled his boots, to be honest. And I just think that he is a player that will elevate any of these teams. Chelsea could do with a prolific goal scorer. City, as we've seen, Man United would benefit hugely from it. And any of these sides, you would think Harry Kane is worth over 100 million quid to them. Now it's going to come down to those resources, isn't it? But yeah, if you were Harry Kane, you would, as Matt says, you would very much relish being on the receiving end of all the chances that City create, and being the guy who can take them to another level. He's certainly capable of that. But yeah, I don't mean there's any doubt that Pep Guardiola will be sitting down with a board and saying, give me another 100 million, 200 million. And Chelsea and City, financial fair play rules have been sort of skewed by the pandemic. And as we know, these two clubs are, along with PSG, are best insulated against a pandemic because of their ownership.
Just quickly, does anyone want to break any Harry Kane news while we're here? Inside scoop? Why leave it for the paper, eh? No. up next, there will be an inside scoop next on Harry Kane. I think he might be making the England squad for the Euros just about. Up next, we'll talk about who might miss out. Stay with us on The Game.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
So, England face Austria at Wembley next on Wednesday before they host Romania on Sunday as they finalise their plans for the Euro 2020 campaign. Firstly, the England manager Gareth Southgate needs to cut down his squad by 7 players. That will happen on Tuesday. Those of you listening on Tuesday, it may have already happened, or Wednesday, of course. Matt Lawton, do you think there are big dilemmas facing Gareth Southgate, or will he know exactly who will and won't be making it?
There's one massive one, which is Trent Alexander-Arnold. I would take him every day. I don't care how good a season Kyle Walker's had. I don't care how well the other sort of right backs have been doing. Yeah, Reece James is certainly in the team for me, but I would absolutely take Trent. He's one of the best strikers of the ball in Europe, and you know, in those tight situations in big games, in a major championship, you know, I think it's, yeah, there's high expectations for this England team, and rightly so. There's some real talent, and it's one of the most exciting England teams I can remember, and been in and around England for, oh, blimey, how long is it now? 25 years. God, Dicko, years. How long is it? I know. and
it feels like 300 years at times.
It does, particularly when most of it's been on the road with you. I just think he's a player that you can, even if you don't pick him from the start, you can bring him on. You know, I was watching, you know, Foden takes a very nice corner. We've seen that, saw that on Saturday night. But I just, we're sort of team with people like Kane and Maguire, hopefully, if he's fit, in the team. You know, there is an aerial threat in that England team. Don't leave him behind. Please don't leave him behind, Gareth. You've got to take him.
Anyone disagree? Should Trent be left out of the squad?
I think the thing, being a 26 rather than a 23 is key, because I think there is room for, you know, I see the debate, but I, you know, I'm with Matt. I would take him, and I would definitely take him now there's 26. I think, you know, I think that those extra 3 spaces make it a no-brainer, because he is the type of guy. I'm not sure he's going to start. Well, I'm pretty sure he's not going to start. I think Kyle Walker will be starting, but you know, you can change a game from right back. We've seen attacking fullbacks are a key part of a game, and he brings, as Matt says, not just that, but some dead ball specialism as well. So, you know, I could definitely imagine his energy being thrown on in a game that England are chasing with half an hour to go.
So, Tom Roddy, you've got Kieran Trippier, Reece James, Kyle Walker, Trent Alexander-Arnold. Who do you leave at home?
It's always tricky because for years and years and years, we've been telling players, young English players, to be bold and brave and kind of go abroad. And then they do, and they're not necessarily right in front of us or fans, and so they don't get the credit that they deserve. So Kieran Trippier is probably the one who is easiest, or it feels easiest to brush to the side, but he is part of an Atletico Madrid team, a Simeone defence, which has won La Liga ahead of Real Madrid and Barcelona, and what an achievement that is. But I think he would probably be the one that I would leave behind, having just said all of that. I think that game on Saturday night really showed how good Reece James can defend. That was very important. But I can't disagree with Trent because of his ability on the ball, because of the chances he creates. And of course, the thing is, I think Kyle Walker will start as well, but the one thing that Southgate has been trying to do over the last year is bring in a plan B or a different plan A, different systems to be able to play with three at the back. And if you play with three at the back, then it gives Trent that license, a bit more license, a bit more protection to cover the area which he is slightly more vulnerable, but it's worth having him on the pitch because for that very reason.
The only thing that makes me think all four of them will go is if Harry Maguire's injury is worse than imagined and he hasn't played the last few games. Of course, he's been hobbling around with an ankle problem. Can England cope Matt Dickinson without Harry Maguire? And if he's missing, do all four go, in your opinion, the right backs?
Well, that's the biggest issue. I think it's a huge issue. I mean, there's sort of rumblings of slightly better news I saw over the weekend, but I think it's key for the squad, because I think Maguire's absence is enough to make you question the whole system. I mean, your next best centre back partnership, you're probably looking at John Stones and Tyrone Mings, and as a two in a four, as an England fan, I'm starting to feel a bit nervous, with all due respect to those guys. So you suddenly think, wow, is this big enough without Maguire that you have to look at a three? And then if you're looking at a three, then you've got to look at the cover for that. I mean, Connor Cody, I think, can work brilliantly for England in a three, not in a four, because that's, is not how he's played for Wolves. I mean, you've got to think about his mobility there. So there's a lot of ramifications on the Maguire fitness, a huge amount. And I don't think it could affect the back four scenario, but equally the Maguire news could affect whether suddenly you're looking at a Ben Godfrey, and does he sneak in as part of a 26? If the Maguire worry is enough, I think if Maguire's going to be fit, then that's almost Gareth Southgate's, biggest issue, both in the finalising the 26 and over the next couple of weeks.
Still think Jordan Henderson's issues as well, missing the last 16 games for Liverpool, will be a big one. I know a lot of people talk about, his leadership and his ability to just be in the squad being a massive boost as well. But if he's really not at it physically, for me, as a manager, with all the great players that you've got, you might have to leave Jordan Henderson at home, which of course would make massive news, but all depends on what the doctors have to say about where he's going to be when the tournament begins. As you two have alluded to, the two Matts, you've been covering England for a long time. Matt Lawton, where do you see this England group approaching the tournament? How much confidence have you got in them?
Yeah, I've got a lot. I look at the potential, the potential scenarios, and I think it's, could be very difficult, and you can't rule out a depressingly early exit. I'm not talking about at the group stage. If they don't get through the group, that would be given the talent, that would be a disaster for Southgate, and would suddenly put his position in jeopardy, I would have thought. But it's a very exciting group. We have been here before, where we've got very excited, particularly 04, 06, because, the individual talent was immense. But there's with people like Mason Mount, with people like Foden, there is real flair and creativity and ability. And look, the worry, as we've just been talking about, is at the back. I think from Declan Rice going forward, it's very, very impressive potentially as a team. And it's just whether they can get them well enough organized at the back not to be vulnerable to, the best forwards in Europe. But I think they've got a great chance. And there was a, even though it is going to be different because of COVID, the fact that the majority of the games are here, it will have, I hope, that feel that we had in Euro 96, where the team gets carried on a bit of a sort of a national wave of sort of euphoria and excitement, and it carries them to the latter stages of the tournament. They're capable of it. Of course they are. It's you know, as I say, we've got one of the best strikers in Europe, some brilliant players backing him up, and as I say, you know, I even a fit Henderson doesn't get in the team for me at the moment. So Declan Rice will be sitting in that position, I'm quite sure, and then it really is what he does with that defence for the reasons that Dicko's just touched on with Maguire. Yeah, Maguire is a concern, and they've got to get that right.
Matt Dickinson, how easy is it to get inside scoops from the England squad right now? Tell us what it used to be like, how you used to get stories from behind the scenes, and have things changed?
Well, the best way to get scoops is with an unhappy camp, because there's always someone willing to bitch against the manager or against his fellow players. So there's been eras that have been a lot easier than this. I mean, I have to say, Southgate's one of the most decent men on earth, but he's a nightmare as a journalist, because A, he's created this camp of harmony. He's created a real trust among the players. He sits them down and speaks to them like adults and basically says, look, guys, this is your show. And if you guys want to give yourselves the best chance, then, you know, you don't go and tell your agents and your family what the team selection is going to be, or you don't go and, you know, bitch around about, you know, this decision or that decision. You take ownership, you take responsibility. And I think that's excellent management, and it's a bloody nightmare for journalists, because the job in some ways is, I think on that sense, has never been harder. I mean, they would say, Matt and I know plenty of eras. I mean, I remember, for example, 2006 World Cup, the fag end of Sven's reign, where, you know, I mean, it was sort of leak central, basically. And, you know, this player would be telling you, you know, I'm pissed off about this, and you should, God, you know, he's a nightmare. We were staying in the same hotel as the families, and they were all, you know, gossip. Yeah, I mean, you could fill the sports pages and the gossip pages all at the same time. So, it is a bizarre tribute to Gareth that this is a hard time to get that sort of scoop.
Hugh, Sven always had a very formulaic approach, and he would always, 2 or 3 days before every game, the team would start training in formation. So everybody knew, all the players knew who was playing from, if the game was on a Saturday, probably from the Wednesday. It'd be, oh, here we go. Yeah, it'd be 11v11. And they'd all work it out. You know, it would be, you know, Michael Owen up front and Beckham on the right, and he'd go, all right, okay, this is the team. And what that then led to was the players that weren't picked would be, all right, I'm not in. And then we would get to find out, you know, what the team was. Normally, as I say, a couple of days in advance. I always remember, you know, Hargreaves being picked for the opening game of the 2002 World Cup, and that was the big story. Owen Hargreaves was starting. It's much harder now. You know, Gareth keeps things much closer to his chest, keeps the players guessing much more, but they have also drilled in. It was Roy Hodgson who really lost it with us when we would write about what we thought the team was going to be ahead of a match. I always took the view that if the opposing manager was picking up the Daily Star and reading the 11, the predicted 11, and was basing his preparation on what was in the British newspapers, I always thought that was slightly reckless. But Roy got very upset about it. And if you remember, at that time, Gareth was at the FA at that time, and I think became part of that culture. It was Roy and Gary Neville used to get really upset with us, and there'd be rows after press conferences going, I can't believe you named our team this morning. And Gareth sort of taken that on, and particularly with the younger players, has really drilled it into them. You know, keep things tight. Don't be telling your agents, as Matt said. And it's much harder to find out what's going on.
Do you think we'll see another long lens moment with a team scribbled down on the back of some paper on Steve Holland's clipboard this time around?
There's been a few long lenses from, you know, don't want to reveal all our secrets, obviously, but there's been some interesting viewpoints that have been discovered down the years. And again, that's the other night. I mean, they train, obviously, they're going to be training at St. George's Park, which is a bit like a, bits of it can be a bit like a sort of Fort Knox complex. So, I don't know if anyone's hired a drone technology particularly to go and swoop over or what, but actually I'm thinking about it.
That's not a bad shout, that.
I was going to say, I've suddenly had an idea and foolishly gone and blabbed it on a podcast.
I know. I think we might lose our accreditation if we did that. Yeah.
No one didn't.
They'll have snipers to bring down our drone or something.
Do you expect anything like that during this tournament at all, Matt? Because if I ask you about maybe your biggest England scoop, do you think we'll see anything similar to that?
Matt's right. Like one story that I sort of was really very lucky to get was the product of an unhappy camp, and that was 2010. People remember there was this extraordinary press conference with John Terry where it almost felt like a coup, and he kind of called Capello out, and he was quite disrespectful towards Capello, questioned his authority. He'd obviously been stripped of the captaincy and wasn't a very happy camper anyway, in South Africa. And I wrote a particularly strong piece criticizing him, and it prompted him to call me the next morning, unhappy with the piece, but also, you know, it was quite weird. It rang me sort of like, well, what have I got to do to get you lot off my back? And what do I do to get out of this mess? And I said, well, I think you need to issue a public apology. He said, well, how do you do that? How do I do that? I said, well, if you want, you can do it through me, you know? So I was very lucky. It was, he rang me on that particular time, but it comes back to Matt's point. Often the better stories come out in terms of the sort of bombshell news stories come out when things are going wrong. Some tournaments are dominated by, you know, for instance, 2006 was dominated by whether Rooney was going to be fit enough. You know, he arrived late, he'd broken his foot. It was all about whether Rooney was going to be capable of making any real contribution to a tournament. It's you never know. Like, you know, this one could be, you know, let's be honest, it could be a COVID outbreak, couldn't it? It could be it could be something like that that derails a team. Every effort will be made. The fact is, St. George's Park will be a proper bubble. But you never know. It's a bit like the Olympics later in the summer. It could be those kind of stories that break this time.
I think Gareth has got a happy camp, and I know that they've been stressing. I did a piece in the Times a couple of weeks ago with Owen Eastwood, this sort of culture guy that's been working with them. And I think particularly with 26 rather than 23, that puts even more emphasis on keeping the camp happy. But there are some interesting selections ahead. I mean, Raheem Sterling, is he getting the starting lineup on form? That's got to be in question. Marcus Rashford, you know, does he get in the starting lineup on form? So there are some, you know, senior-ish players who might end up on the sidelines, which is, you know, isn't to say suddenly that means the morale falls apart. But Gareth himself has said the biggest, or one of the biggest tests of the weeks ahead is going to be with a bigger squad, keeping everyone happy, keeping them on board. There will be three players sitting in the stands twiddling their thumbs every match. You know, they're not even going to make the bench. So that is, that sort of harmony is all part of the challenge of management in a tournament, not just picking the team in the right place and sending them out with the right tactics.
Having covered all the England tournaments that you guys have, what did you think when Gareth made the announcement that he was going to do the provisional squad, sort of delaying? There was all this talk and speculation about, especially over Trent and the decisions he has to make, and now it's just been delayed. Did you think that was a wise decision? Or
I thought it was sensible.
I could understand it. I mean, I do think it was a recognition above all that this is less than ideal. I mean, the fact is that we've got two matches this week which are going to not involve the Champions League players, which is, you know, you've got absolutely key players like Mount and Foden, who to me are, you know, two of the first names on the team sheet, have to play, have to start. and they're not going to be playing this week. You know, it was a recognition of that. It was a recognition that Maguire, we've got this big worry about that we talked before. That's a big, big worry. You know, Henderson's coming back. Grealish is coming back. So I think, you know, I understood it, but, you know, I think it has to be recognised that it was a recognition by Gareth Southgate that preparation, a lot of it, for reasons he cannot control, is particularly difficult and unsatisfactory. And, you know, you just hope that as many of those issues can, you know, be resolved as possible by the time we're kicking off.
I do think there is a feeling that the media, the English football journalists and the national team have not always been in harmony, and that has played a part in England and their performances in competitions. At least it seems to have been alluded to by coaches in the past, managers of England in the past. Tom Roddy, I just wondered, look, I love sports journalism. Everyone listening to this, I'm sure does, what the newspaper reactions will be like if Trent Alexander-Arnold is one of the names left out of the squad. You know, will we get that right from the off? What's Gareth thinking? And will that maybe play a part as we head into these games? And then, of course, the opening match of the tournament.
Yeah, of course. I think so, because of what we've spoken about throughout this whole podcast about Trent and what he offers. And the thing is, we've got to remember as well, is when he was left out of the team, however many months ago it was now, it was understandable. It was understandable at the time because he was having a really bad season with Liverpool. But that selection, it appears, gave him the kick up the backside. And ever since then, he has been absolutely outstanding for Liverpool. And Gareth has always said throughout his time as manager that he will pick his team, he will pick his squad based entirely on form. Now, maybe there's a few tweaks to that. I think, you know, Jordan Henderson, having not played since the middle of February, he goes if he can because of his experience. But he picks his teams on form. And Trent, he is fortunate enough to have four right backs who are in fantastic form, but you can't leave Trent out of that. And it's such a debatable subject, and it will upset a lot of people, that we would definitely be getting into that from the off.
The thing is, performance dictates everything in that relationship. That, you know, you just ask that question, and you know, Matt and I have been in at tournaments when it's been awful, the relationship, and other ones when it's been, and it's been terrific, particularly the last one. It's completely dictated by performance. I do think that the majority of journalists who cover England want them to do well. The fact of the matter is, it's brilliant when England do well in terms of, from a journalistic experience perspective. You know, it's, you know, Russia was fantastic, being on that journey with them. It's all about performance. Yeah, it is when things go wrong that relations become strained. You know, we talk about England scoops. You know, one of the ones that Matt broke, which was, took me months to recover because I didn't have it as a story. It absolutely killed me. Was and I've never forgiven him. But no, it was the threat of a strike. You know, the player's strike before, you know, the final qualifying game of before Euro 2004, you know, on the back of the Rio Ferdinand drug test ban. And you had players, England players, threatening to strike. That's got nothing to do with the relationship between the media and the England team. That was to do with the relationship between the England team and the FA. And the players were very unhappy that because Rio had left the training ground and had missed a drugs test, he was getting banned. He'd been banned. And you had Gary Neville and other players threatening not to play in Istanbul in that final qualifier, a story broken by Matt and one or two others, not by me. That phone call at 10:30 still haunts me. You know, but it's
to be fair, you've got your fair share of retaliation in since.
That's been my main motivating factor, Dicko. Has just been revenge. I've been driven by revenge for 18 years. No, but it's That's the thing. And what one of Gareth's great successes has been to create harmony. But he's also shown, you know, strength of leadership. You know, when they had that situation with Gomez and Sterling, you know, that was strong leadership, that, to leave Sterling out of that next game. And I think he's, you know, again, it will be dictated by performance. If they lose to Croatia and then get a draw against Scotland, well, it ain't just going to be the relationship between the press and the England team that's the problem. It's going to be everybody's going to be unhappy. So it really is. It's performance driven, that relationship.
Just before we go, I did want to give a special mention to Brentford, who won the playoff final, beating Swansea 2-0. They're back in the top flight for the first time since 1947. I just wanted to say every football fan needs to watch the film Moneyball, otherwise they will not get any of the references from the commentators on the opening weekend. Okay, so if you haven't seen it, you don't get the model at Brentford, you need to, otherwise it's going to go straight over your head. But it's another West London side, Matt Dickinson, into the Premier League, you know.
Yes, I know. You might see that I'm actually wearing my QPR retro shirt given to me last Christmas by one of my sons. Thomas Frank, actually, I think he's just moved in around the corner. Seriously, I saw him. He walks his dog past my house most days, and I'm going to have to go up and shake him by the hand and say congratulations, which, say, as a QPR season ticket holder, is going to hurt, basically. I have warned him that the street is full of QPR fans, which it is. So whether it'll be getting a hard time when he walks past. But no, I have to say, even that aside, they deserve it. I think they've been a team that have been pushing at this door for quite a few years now. They dare to be different. They've got a different, you know, the way that they go about their recruitment of managers, the way they try and inform it with, as you say, with the Moneyball approach is a sort of the best sort of umbrella title for it. The way that they, you know, at the time, I thought clumsily wrote about the time, clumsily got rid of their academy, didn't handle it the best, but there was a rationale to it. They dare to be different. They dare to think, you know what, we're not going to produce all these kids to be nicked by the big clubs. We're going to try and take in kids at 16 to 18 and try and, you know, polish them up into players. So yeah, there's a lot of thought goes into, there's a strategy, and it's a strategy that's paying off. I think they've played some good football. You know, I think it's great seeing someone like Tony, you know, sort of, you know, I'd love to see how he gets on in the Premier League. So yeah, no, fair play to them. I think of all the playoff teams, they deserve it, and they deserve it for sort of chipping away for some time now.
Tom Roddy, do you think they've got enough next season, or how much do you think they need to build this summer?
Yeah, they deserve it, but also they're ready for it, aren't they? Because they've been building towards this moment. I mean, you've seen playoff finals over the years where a team has made it in, like, say, Derby, for example, and been on the verge of being in the Premier League, and look where they are now. Same thing with Reading happened a few years ago, get to the playoff final and then fall away. Whereas Brentford, if it hadn't have happened this year, you'd have still felt like it could have happened next year, automatic or not. They've been built the right way, and it was important for them that they went up, because I think Ivan Toney would have been in the Premier League no matter what. It's also great to have a fresh new club in the Premier League. The only thing is six clubs from London in the Premier League is quite astonishing. It might benefit me and Dicko a little bit, but it's a little astonishing.
Going to keep you busy on the news front.
Yes, yeah.
Can I just add, Hugh, on Brentford? I'm really pleased with their fans. My year started, this calendar year started writing about a faction of Brentford fans that had developed in the wider group that was really unpleasant, that was organized hooliganism, racism, Nazi propaganda, really unpleasant group of Brentford fans. But it was other Brentford fans who came to me with this evidence and came to me with this, with the stuff that some of these guys are putting on social media. And the club reacted brilliantly. They've banned these people. They've driven them out of the club. It was the other fans that the right minded fans didn't want them being part of their club, and were responsible for, you know, as I say, seeking out a journalist who then brought this to the attention of the wider attention. The club dealt with it, and I have to say the club were even, because yeah, the response to some of these guys was very unpleasant. They identified a fan wrongly, actually, as being one of my sources. They sent him excrement through the post, threatened him. And I received some fairly unpleasant messages through social media. I got a call from the director of football at the club, never met the bloke in my life, but rang me up to check I was all right. Of course, I was fine, but I thought that was very decent. And I just think, for me, I took particular pleasure in that the other day, because I just thought, for a set of football fans to police themselves and think, you know what, we don't want these guys coming with us on Saturday. And I just really hope they get to enjoy the Premier League next season. And those guys, they won't be there to enjoy it with them. And I think that's great.
Absolutely, couldn't agree more. And it could have been that they went up to the Premier League last year and maybe their fans would have only got that one solitary game. So hopefully they do get to fill out their new stadium at some point next season and enjoy their team in the Premier League as well. Matt Lawton, Matt Dickinson and Tom Roddy, thank you so much for being with me on the Game Podcast for the last hour or so. We'll be back on Thursday looking at those England selections from Gareth Southgate and how they've performed against Austria. But remember, if you're enjoying the podcast, firstly, give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcast from, but make sure you are subscribed to The Times and The Sunday Times. You can get it across all of your devices, and if you sign up today, you will also get yourself a month free. Go online, search thetimes.co.uk/thegame.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.